Hi, and welcome to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers on 90.5 FM. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Naomi Shihab Nye. Naomi Shihab Nye is an award-winning poet, writer, anthologist, and educator. She is the author and or editor of more than 28 volumes. Her books of poetry include 19 Varieties of Gazelle, Poems of the Middle East, Amaze Me, Poems for Girls, Red Suitcase, Words Under the Words, Fuel, You and Yours, which is a best-selling poetry book of 2006, and her new book, Honeybee, was just released from HarperCollins, which is a book of poems and short prose. Her books of essays include Never in a Hurry and I'll Ask You Three Times, Are You Okay?, Tales of Driving and Being Driven. Her many prize-winning anthologies for young writers include This Same Sky and The Space Between Our Footsteps, Poems and Paintings from the Middle East. She has been a Lannan Fellow, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a Witter Binner Fellow from the Library of Congress. She has received a Levon Award from the Academy of American Poets, the Isabella Gardner Poetry Award, the Lee Bennett Hopkins Poetry Award, the Patterson Poetry Prize, 4 Pushcart Prizes, and numerous honors for her children's literature, including 2 Jane Addams Children Book Awards. Naomi Shihab Nye describes herself as a wandering poet. She has spent many years traveling the country and the world, leading writing workshops with students of all ages. She was born to a Palestinian father and an American mother and grew up in St. Louis, Jerusalem, and San Antonio. And welcome. How are you?
Hi, Jen. So great to be back in Pittsburgh.
We're always glad when you come to Pittsburgh, and we want to thank the Cultural Trust this time for making that possible. So welcome again.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to come here. Thanks to the Cultural Trust, indeed.
And you're going to start with some poems.
Yep.
Right?
I'll read a few short ones here.
Okay.
How far is it to the land we left? On the first day of his life, the baby opens his eyes and gets tired doing even that. He cries when they place a cap on his head. Too much, too much. Later the whole world will touch him, and he won't even flinch. This is called What Kind of Fool Am I? He sang with abandon, combing his black, black hair. Each morning in the shower, first in Arabic, rivery ripples of song carrying him back to his first beloved land, then in English, where his repertoire was short. No kind at all, we'd shout, throwing ourselves into the brisk arc of his cologne for a morning kiss. But he gave us freedom to be fools if we needed to, which we certainly would later, which we all do now and then. Perhaps a father's greatest gift, that blessing. And one other short one. This is called Ted Kooser is My President. And I would like to say that I just had my first trip to Nebraska a couple of weeks ago. It was very exciting. I now just have 2 states that I've never visited, unlike coming here so many times to wonderful Pennsylvania. But I still have never been to Montana or North Dakota. But the other one was Nebraska, and finally got there. And it was inspiring to see Ted Kooser, our wonderful poet, and get to see the old antique grocery store that he's turned into his office, and in a little town called Dwight. So here's a poem I wrote, though, before I met him. When I travel abroad, I will invoke Ted's poems at checkpoints. Yes, barns. Yes, memory, gentility, the quiet little wind among stones. If they ask, you are American? I will say, Ted's kind of American. No, I carry no scissors or matches. Yes, horizons, dinner tables. Yes, weather, the honesty of it. Buttons, chickens. Feel free to dump my purse. I'll wander to the window, stare out for days. Actually, I have never been to Nebraska, except with Ted, who hosted me dozens of times, though we have never met. His deep assurance comforts me. He's not big on torture at all. He could probably sneak into your country when you weren't looking and say something really good about it. Have you noticed those purple blossoms in a clump beside your wall?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Naomi Shihab Nye. That's a great poem.
Oh, thank you.
I love Ted Kooser also. But you were talking about an article that you had read in the paper also that before we began. And
yeah, I was just every day, you know, my father was a journalist, and so he sort of trained us just instinctively to note quotes in newspapers, which you might want to think about a little further, or quotes you might want to ask more questions about. And this morning I was reading about a tribal leader in Iraq, and in the story there was a quote by a military spokesman for the United States, and the quote is, "Any heavy-handedness would not be looked on kindly by us." Well, I mean, I laughed out loud at the breakfast table, although it's not funny. It's tragic. And just the outrageous irony that we have been living with in the last 5 years, more years than that, but particularly in the last 5 years as relates to the invasion of Iraq by our country. And then a quote about heavy-handedness. You know, I kind of have played off that that elaborate delusion that is going on right now in the world in many of my poems in recent books. And I can't get away from it. I'd like to get away from it. Peace and war are not my favorite topics. A peace might be, but war certainly isn't. And when you keep reading quotes that make you raise your eyebrows and say, ridiculous, or how can they possibly say that in the context of what's been going on, all the more occasion for poetry which asks questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know that you travel all the time, and I've heard you read in Pittsburgh a number of times, which has been great. But one thing that always strikes me is how immediately you break through any kind of barriers with people and how you always connect the political and the poem, which maybe is inherently connected anyway, but you foreground that in such a brave way, and the conversation becomes much deeper than it might have otherwise been, and deeper than it is sometimes when other poets come to town. Really. So can you talk about that? Is that one of your aims, one of your desires to get everybody talking on that level?
Well, you're very kind to say that, Jen, very generous. Certainly, I feel that one of the tasks of poetry is to stimulate conversation and to help us listen with a little bit, ears which feel a little bit more precise or more tuned to the irony or the perplexity of our situation. Perhaps because I had an Arab father, I feel certainly a responsibility to continue to humanize the world he came from and was part of and loved so much. And I think that poetry is a zoom lens on experience, whether you're writing about local Pittsburgh experience or experience on the other side of the world. You want to try to bring things into a closer focus as opposed to a more distant, sort of blurred, masked, impressionistic, you know, abstraction. And so I honor poetry for its particularity. And I try always to have some kind of small hinge in the poem which feels as if it belongs to reality, to daily life. It's easy to imagine, to see, even if you've never been to the place it's talking about. I'm mightily inspired, though, I have to say, by so many poets I read, and so many of them from Pittsburgh over the years, by you, Jan, by Dr. Samuel Hazo, who has been one of my personal heroes since the early 80s. I have appreciated the International Poetry Forum here in Pittsburgh, which brings voices together and has created such a marvelous democratic audience for poetry, but also Sam Hazo's commitment to speaking truth and writing op-ed pieces, even when it's an exhausting topic, or, you know, bringing into the foreground outrageous commentaries, which we need to think further about and which our government would just have us accept and go on merrily along our way. And so Sam functions as not only a visionary poet, but also someone who speaks in a political context. And I try to do that in a small way, you know, in poems myself, as well as in my frequent letters to the editor. Recently, you'll laugh at this. Recently, I wrote a very simple little letter to the editor. I think it had like three sentences in it relating to the recent primaries in Texas, and you all now in Pennsylvania are in the boat we were, the very dramatic primaries. And somebody wrote into the letters to the editor column saying, shut that woman up. tell her to stop. All she should do is keep writing. And I thought, well, letters to the editor are writing. How dare they say, just keep writing. I am writing. That's what I'm doing. And when we were kids, my dad was always poking us, you know, write letters to the editor about issues you feel strongly about. You know, that's your responsibility as a citizen. Of course, we couldn't send them to our local papers because he worked for the local papers. So we often had to send them, you know, to other papers in other cities. And it was amazing to us, you know, when they would be published.
Okay. Can you read some more poems? Or
sure. Well, as I'm picking out little short ones, of course, I think I have the feeling that many, as many people do, that you know, sometimes speaking for God is a dangerous thing, or pretending you can translate for God. Don't say, God said. You made it up, then put it in God's pocket. God may have thrown it out already. That's from Honeybee. By the way, my beloved editor suggested I might consider throwing that poem out of the book.
Really?
And I thought that was very funny since the poem was about things being thrown out. So I refused. It was one of the few occasions which I've stood against her opinion. This is called The Cost. And I often tell students that my poems may not sound like it, but I actually work on them a long time. I try to achieve a very commonplace sort of vernacular, a very talky vernacular. But in the case of this particular poem, this does stand very much as it was in the first draft. The Cost. How deeply agreeable the word reed appearing in the word thread. A church marquee in Wisconsin asked, what does it take to make peace? A lot, apparently. We could start with all the elementary school librarians and counselors fired here last night for lack of funds. Peacemakers, every one of them. I'd place my money on it. So many lives threading out into the wilderness of adulthood, fortified by books and good advice. Oh, students, we will teach you everything you need to know. Then place a gun in your hands? Makes sense, doesn't it? No sense seems common anymore. I was working in a wonderful town in Wisconsin where during the big literary week, I wasn't the only writer. They had many children's book illustrators, other writers, educators appearing there under the umbrella of Literary Week, and that was the very week on which the school board met and fired 17 librarians and counselors from within that very same district that was sponsoring our visit. So, of course, the teachers we were working with were deeply depressed that week because they were losing these essential people from their own schools, and it was being described as a funds issue. And I just couldn't believe that in a society which has a lot of good work to do in the public school area and a lot of traumatic issues involving violence, which I think counselors might be critical players in stories of violence or potential violence. I just couldn't believe that those were the people who were being fired. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually, I was always troubled by the term common sense when I was little, because often common sense seemed like something that was critical sense more than common. I mean, you couldn't take it for granted. And by sort of downplaying it as, oh, this is common sense, everyone knows it, it was almost as if you were saying, so therefore we don't ever need to mention it. And these days, you know, when so much money is given to the military machine and good programs in education are being cut from coast to coast, I really think we need to question what is common sense. Mm-hmm. Where is it? How could we reclaim it?
Mm-hmm. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Naomi Shihab Nye. Since you are traveling all the time, and I know that you know, tell me if this is correct. I think it is. You've traveled to the Middle East and Asia for the United States Information Agency, which I wasn't sure what that was.
Well, in the old days, there was a wonderful program. It does not exist anymore in the same way. And my husband, Michael Nye, who's a photographer, wonderful photographer, and I traveled under a program called Arts America, which was an exchange program sending artists to other countries and actually bringing artists from other countries to the United States to share their work. And the idea was that an important kind of communication went on through art. And we were very careful before we accepted those jobs to learn whether we were being expected to convey a sort of party line about the United States, or did we have to say that we, for example, agreed with political policies of the time, or, you know, if somebody asked us, of course, as they always did, very specific political questions, could we answer with our honest opinions, or, you know, just because our expenses were being paid by the U.S. Information Agency, how much official information were we supposed to convey? Mm-hmm. And, thankfully, we were encouraged to speak up for our own opinions and say, you know, if we disagreed with policies of our government, since freedom of speech is one of our greatest honors and privileges in this country, that we were allowed and encouraged to participate freely, say whatever we thought. That program has been canceled. Are we surprised?
Seems like a trend here.
Yeah, it was a good program. It didn't cost much either. And really, really good things happened. There are different kinds of exchanges using artists these days, but they're a little more difficult to participate in. I think you have to stay a longer time in the host country, and you have to travel with other artists. And I'm not quite sure how it all works, and I'm not quite sure which division of the government is sponsoring it. But those were wonderful years for Michael and me in terms of feeling the profound power of art in whatever genre, in his case visual, in my case literary, to connect human beings in other places. And of course, we were often sent to places that didn't like the U.S. that much. Mm-hmm. You know, I was asked to meet with the anti-U.S. reporters of Dhaka, Bangladesh, mm-hmm. repeatedly. And they were amazing guys. I mean, I ended up being really good friends with these guys. And I think some of them did change their tune about our country. They were pleased that, you know, that they could meet an American who was on an official kind of American trip, who could say, yeah, you're right, I don't like what they're doing either. Mm-hmm. And so that was beneficial. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important, Jen, and I know you know this, but I can't say it enough to my beloved fellow Americans and Pennsylvanians, whom I appreciate so much over the years, that we all continue to speak our minds and not feel cowed. You know, I meet so many people in different communities in the United States who say, I wish I could speak more freely. Mm-hmm. And I often say, well, why can't you? Mm-hmm. And of course, many times it's, well, I'm afraid I'll lose my job, or I'm afraid I'll get into trouble, or I'm afraid of making people in my community mad. But as Americans, if we give up that right of speaking freely, the notion of bringing democracy to people in other lands becomes even more far-fetched than it is to begin with.
Right.
So we have to retain that right. And, you know, if you think this invasion of another country is bad, please keep saying it, because the losses are too great for everyone.
Well, I think that, you know, your poetry and your writing is a great vehicle for you, and I mean, because it gets you everywhere. I mean, well, it doesn't get you. You take it everywhere, because there are plenty of writers who don't do the wandering and the visiting that you do. So can we hear a little more of your work? I want people to hear your poems.
You're very kind. Well, I hate to say it, but this poem was written back in the 90s. I just wish it were obsolete. And this poem is referring to the ongoing struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis for basic human rights and some kind of equivalency, autonomy, shared, collaborative life together, which is my dream. How long peace takes. As long as a mirror opening its eye to stretch a room lengthwise. As long as the slow crawl of loosening paint, the bending of slim wax tapers. As long as blue thread spinning a vine of birds up one seam, down the other, and the bodice, don't forget the bodice, doubly thick with wings and hidden treasure. As long as my Sitti twists her hanky around two small gold coins in the bed, and says she is not tired. As long as the bed and all the people who slept in it. As long as the splitting of almonds, the stirring of lentils, the scent of meramia, and the universal laundry. As long as the question, what if I were you? Has two heads. As long as the back of the skull is vulnerable, and the temple, and the chest. As long as anyone feels exempt or better, and one pain is separate from another, and people are pressed flat in any place, and longer, if every day the soldier slaps another cousin's face. I wrote that poem on the day after one of my 11-year-old second cousins, he's the child of one of my first cousins, had been brutally beaten up in his shower. Picture this, a nude 11-year-old boy taking a shower, and a soldier busts in full of artillery, an Israeli soldier, a Palestinian boy, busts into the shower, which would scare anyone if anyone busted into your shower, and brutally beat him up in the shower when he was naked because there was a rumor that my little cousin's son might have known some boys in another village who had thrown rocks the week before. It was one of those very far-fetched, abstract paybacks. And I was there when this child, wet, bruised, and bleeding, came into the room of the next house where I was sitting with my grandmother, who was 106 at the time, and weeping, told us his story. And we were stunned. We couldn't believe this. And by that time, this soldier had sped off in the tank. And I thought, another thing we pay for, we U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you go and read your poems, do you run into and talk? Do you want to run into some resistance ever? Or does... Do you find that you, instead, good conversations, minds are changed, or things start to move around? What's your experience been?
You know, it would be very presumptuous of me to say minds are changed. One always hopes that maybe someone might think of someone else. Oh, there are human beings there. When I hear kids, or I get letters from kids saying later, you know, we never really think about there being kids in Iraq or what they might be suffering, but your poems made us think about that more. Oh, when you talked about the Palestinians as if they were human beings instead of militants, which is all we ever hear in U.S. news, when you reminded us that there is militancy on both sides and it's a little overplayed in our media, you know, which way it's going, that was an important lesson. You know, I think we have to keep stimulating dialogue, reminding. I haven't received too much resistance. A few years ago, I was invited to a school in the Bronx, New York, and all the kids in the junior high sixth, seventh, and eighth grades were asked to read Habibi, my first novel for teens, which is about an Arab-American girl, Palestinian-American, and a Jewish boy who become friends. And the head of the school called me before my visit, and she said, I think I should tell you that a lot of parents are very angry that we've asked the students to read your book. And this is primarily a Jewish school, primarily Jewish student body. And I said, well, have you told the parents that the hero of my book, the second hero of my book, is a Jewish boy with a lot of charisma? And the head of the school said, yes, I have. And I've urged them to read the book to see that he is portrayed very attractively and that the friendship between the two young people is really the central characterization in the book. And they just don't like it because it expresses the humanity of Arabs. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, it's your call. If you want me not to come, I won't come. But if you believe that that's an important topic, perhaps I should come. And she said, no, I do. And, you know, I just wanted you to know that if they're having a demonstration in front of the school when your car pulls up, it's not the way I would have wanted to welcome you. And I got there. And the interesting thing that happened, though, was they had another visiting writer, a Jewish writer, on the same day, who was actually a graduate of that school. And all of the high school students had been asked to read her amazing book called Martyr's Crossing. Her name is Amy Wilentz. And Amy told me in the car that there also had been antagonism about her visit because Arabs were presented as human beings in her book as well. So we joked about this, talked even about the possibility of trading identities. And then everything turned out great. The kids welcomed us. And, you know, when I was able to say to the kids right away, before anything else, I said, before we talk about my book, I just want you to know that I do believe Arab people and Jewish people are cousins. They don't have to be enemies. And many of my best friends in my life have been Jewish. And I could just see, you know, the tensed up, folded arms fall down.
Relaxing.
And it was good. They were relaxing.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. If you could have do you have anything short that we could close with?
Sure. Blood. A true Arab knows how to catch a fly in his hands, my father would say. And he'd prove it, cupping the buzzer instantly, while the host with the swatter stared. Years before, a girl knocked, wanted to see the Arab. I said we didn't have one. After that, my father told more stories. Shihab, shooting star, good name, borrowed from the sky. Once I said, when we die, we give it back. He said, that's what a true Arab would say. Today the headlines, clot in my blood. Homeless figs, this tragedy with a terrible root is too big for us. What flag can we wave? I call my father, we talk around the news. It is too much for him. Neither of his two languages can reach it. I drive into the country to find sheep, cows, to plead with the air. Who calls anyone civilized? Where can the crying hearts graze? What does a true Arab do now?
The poetry of Naomi Shihab Nye. Thank you so much, Naomi. I think we need more time, though.
Thank you, Jan. Thanks for listening to me always.
That's great. You've been listening to Prosody, featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody on 90.5 FM.